Yes. That is really moving, said the steward. The tears stood in his eyes. He nodded to the old man, who nodded back, rubbing his hands and smiling. When one has troubles in the world, like me, and sometimes feels not too good about the kidneys, one is moved by things like that. Can we then, in the name of Set, he turned back to his scribe, use a young slave, as a lamplighter, perhaps, or as a floor-sprinkler? What do you say, Kah Ma'at? He said to a tall, stoop-shouldered man who carried several reed pens behind each ear. Do we need one? The scribes made gestures of indecision, seeming to debate. They stuck out their lips, drew their heads down between their shoulders, and flapped their hands in the air. Need, answered he who was called Kah Ma'at, is need to want, to lack the indispensable? Then no, but even the unnecessary may be made useful. It depends on the cost. If the man of the desert would sell you a scribe, then drive him away, for we are writers enough, and neither need nor can use one. But if he offer you a baser slave, for the dogs or for the bathing room, then inquire of him his price. Well, old man, said the steward, hasten then and say what you would ask for your son of the well. He is yours, replied the Ishmaelite. Since we speak of him at all, and you ask me about him, he already belongs to you. Truly, it is not fit that I decide on the worth of the present in exchange, which, as it would seem, you will make me. But since you command, the ape sits beside the scale, whose sins in measure and weight is convicted by the power of the moon. 200 devon of copper the slave must be reckoned at, considering his extraordinary properties, but the little onions and the wine from Khadati I will throw in as a gauge of friendship. The price was high. It was a clever stroke to make extras of the shallots and the much-liked Phoenician wine, and to charge only for the young slave Osarsif. But high it was, even granted that of all the old man's stock in trade, not excepting the famous myrrhs, only this single thing paid for the transportation to Egypt. It was high even from the point of view that the Ishmaelites' entire business was only an extra, and their sole and single significance consisted in the fact that they were bringing the boy Joseph down to Egypt in order to fulfill the ordained. We may not venture to think that any such idea entered the old Minoan's head. Certainly it was remote from the overseer Montcalm's, and probably he would have protested against the overcharge if the dwarf Dudu had not forestalled him. From under the thatch of the little man's lip, a full-mouthed protest rolled out. The tiny hands at the end of his stumps of arms gesticulated before his breast. "It is absurd," he said. "Utterly fantastic, and not to be borne. Turn your back on him. Show your disgust to this shameless old thief and vagabond who dares to speak of friendship, as though there could be anything of the kind between you, an Egyptian overseer to the great, and him, a wild man from the desert. His business is pure swindle, asking 200 copper debon for this lout here." And he gestured palm upwards at Joseph as he stood beside him. "For such worthless trash, a snot-nosed sand-rabbit. It is all highly suspicious to me. He may be able to prattle about moss and murmuring streams, but who knows what sort of abandoned vices brought him to acquaintance with the pit that the old rascal is supposed to have got him from. I say you shall not buy the lout. My advice is not to acquire him for petipray. He will not thank you for it." Thus Dudu, overseer of the wardrobe. But hard upon his voice came a little pipe like a cricket's out of the grass, the voice of Beauty in the gala attire, the vizier who stood at Joseph's other side, for they had taken him between them. "Buy, Montcalm," he whispered, standing on his tiptoes. "Buy the sand boy. Of all the seven gifts, buy him alone, for he is the best. Trust me, I have the use of my eyes. Good, beautiful, and wise is Osarsif. Blessed is he, and will be a blessing to the house. Hearken to the voice of wisdom." "Take not the advice of the base, but of the worthy," cried the other in his turn. "How can this dried-up nothing give you anything of worth, being himself without worth, and like a rotten nut with nothing but dust and wind inside. He has no weight in the world, no social value, but bobs on the surface of things like a cork. How can a clown and a court fool speak anything of value, or have judgment of human folk and their goods, or of human goods? "Oh, you stuck-up little busybody, you!" shrieked Bess Emheb, his gnome face crumpled into a thousand wrinkles with sheer rage. "How can you have judgment or give counsel, you backslider and turncoat? You threw away your wisdom when you denied your dwarfdom and wived yourself with a tall woman, and gave life to long, lath-like children called Esesi and Ebebi, you pompous ass. You remained a dwarf according to your stature, and cannot see over the boundary stone of the field, but as for your stupidity, that is full size, and it has entirely blunted your judgment of men and wares and human wares." Dudu was brought by these epithets and this description of his mental state to a pitch of almost incredible fury. He got white as cheese. The thatch quivered on his upper lip, and he burst out in venomous invective, which Beauty was not slow in repaying with even more malicious allusions to Dudu's loss of finer intelligence, his renegade state, and ridiculous pretensions. The two little men stood, hands on knees, on Joseph's either side, as though he were a tree, scolding and spitting at each other round him. The crowd, Egyptians and Ishmaelites together, and the overseer with them, roared with laughter at this petty war going on at the level of their knees. But suddenly, everything came to a stop. Potiphar. From afar in the street, sounds came and swelled. The trampling of horses, the rolling of wheels, the thud of running feet, and many-voiced cries of warning. It all came on so fast that in no time it stood before the door. "There we are," said Montcalm. "The master, and the arrangements in the dining hall? Great triad of Thebes, I have wasted my time in sheer folly. Quiet, ye underlings, or you shall have a taste of the lash. Kamaat, conclude the bargain. I must go with the master into the house. Take the goods and pay a proper price for them. Keep well, old man, and come back again, in 6 or 7 years' time." He hastened away. The gatekeepers, from the benches, shouted into the court, and from all sides servants came running in zeal to line up before the master with their foreheads to the ground. The trotting feet of the runners and the rattle of the car came from the gateway. Petipre drove in. Before him went his panting, shouting runners. Among and behind them his fan-bearers came. Two proud and glossy chestnuts in fine trappings, with ostrich plumes on their heads, drew the little two-wheeled car, a sort of gala chariot with prettily curved rails. In it was just room for himself and his driver. But the driver did nothing save to add to the splendor of the equipage, for Pharaoh's friend drove himself. It was plain from his bearing and his attire that it was the master who held reins and whip. He was an extremely tall, fat man, with a little mouth, Joseph remarked, but only at a glance, for his eyes went rather to the wheels of the chariot, which had bright stones let into the spokes and sparkled like fireworks as they whirled round in the sun. Joseph wished that little Benjamin might see it. The same splendor, though not whirling, repeated itself on Petipre's person, for he wore a jeweled collar, a magnificent piece of workmanship, set with stones and enamel in all colors. Their countless facets, arranged in rows with the narrow sides together, flashed like a rain of sparks in the strong white light which the sun god at his zenith was pouring down on Weset and upon this very spot. The ribs of the runners panted in and out. The shining steeds came to a halt, pawing the ground, rolling their eyes and snorting. A groom held them by the bridle, patted their foaming necks, and murmured soothing words. The chariot had stopped by the palm trees just between the group of merchants and the gate in the ring wall which led into the inner court. And at the gate stood Montcalm, bowing and smiling and gesturing his delight. His head was trembling with sheer admiration as he stepped up to the car and offered his hand to help the master alight. Petipre handed reins and whip to the driver, keeping in his small hand only a short staff made of cane and gilded leather, thick at the end and looking like a kind of reduced bludgeon. "Wash them off with wine, cover them well, and lead them about," he commanded in a thinnish voice, lifting his staff and pointing to the animals with that elegant survival of a savage weapon become in his hands merely a symbol of his power. He waved back the hand offered by Montcalm and sprang down, with a movement agile for one of his weight, though he might as easily have stepped. Joseph saw and heard clearly, especially after the car moved slowly off toward the stables and the master and his steward stood gazing after it in full view of the group of Ishmaelites. The great man might be perhaps 40 years old or less, and like a tower for size. Joseph could not help thinking of Reuben, as he looked at the columnar legs showing through the royal linen of the outer garment, which came not quite to the ankles, and revealed the pleats and ribbons of the skirt through its thin weave. But this massiveness was not heroic like Brother Reuben's, for it was fat. Fat everywhere, especially on the breasts, which stood out like two hillocks under the thin batiste. They had shaken not a little with the man's unnecessarily active jump from the car. His head was quite small in proportion to his height and breadth, but nobly shaped, with short hair, short, aristocratically hooked nose, delicate mouth, pleasantly prominent chin, and long-lashed eyes with a veiled and haughty gaze. Standing with the steward in the shade of the palms, he looked well pleased after his horses as they were led off. "They are very fiery," he was heard to say. "User Min, even more than Wepwawet. They were unruly. They tried to bolt, but I got the better of them." "As only you can do," answered Montcalm. "It is amazing. Your driver, Netternacht, would not dare cope with them, nor any of the others here. The Syrians are so wild. They have fire, not blood, in their veins. They are not horses, but demons. Yet you have conquered them. They feel the master's hand, and their pride is subdued. They are tamed and run in harness for you. And you, after triumphing in the struggle with them, are not even tired. You spring like a lad from your car, my lord." The deep corners of Petitpré's mouth deepened more in a fleeting smile. "I have further intent," said he, "to pay homage to Sebek this afternoon and go hunting in the marshes. Make all ready and rouse me betime should I fall asleep. Put throw sticks and fishing spears in the boat, and harpoons as well, for I hear that a hippopotamus of great size has strayed into the backwater where I mean to hunt, and I am minded most of all to kill it." "The mistress," answered Montcalm, his eyes cast down, "the mistress, Mut M. Ennet, will tremble with fear when she hears. Be persuaded at least not to attack the brute single-handed. Leave the struggle and the danger to your servants." "The mistress." "That gives me no pleasure," Petitpré responded. "I will myself hurl the spear." "But the mistress will be afraid." "Let her be afraid. But," he asked, turning with a swift movement toward the steward, "is all well in the house? Not untoward has befallen? Nothing? And what people are those? Traveling merchants? Very good. The mistress is happy. Is all well with the exalted parents in the upper story?" "Order and well-being reign," Montcalm gave answer. "Our gracious mistress went in her litter toward noon to visit the Lady Renanutet, wife of the head steward of the Bulls of Amun, to practice hymn singing with her. When she returned, she sent for Tepem Ankh, scribe of the House of the Secluded Ones, to read fairy tales to her, the while she felt desire to kiss the sweetmeats which your servant sent her. As for the exalted parents from the upper story, it pleased them to cross the river to make sacrifice in the tomb of Thutmose, father of God, united with the sun. Returned from the west, the exalted brother-sister pair, Huia and Tuia, have spent the time sitting peacefully hand in hand in the pleasure house by the pond, awaiting your return and the hour of the evening meal. You may tell them, too, and let it come privily to them," the master said, "that I mean to hunt the hippopotamus this very day. They may as well know it." "But on that account," replied the steward, "they will, alas, fall into anxiety and great distress." "No matter," retorted Petitpré. "It seems," he added, "that life here today has gone to everybody's liking, whereas I had annoyance at court and vexation in the palace Merrimat." "You?" Montcalm questioned in dismay. "How can that be? For the good God in the palace, either a man is captain of the guard," the master was heard to say, shrugging his massive shoulders as he turned away, and head executioner, or else he is not. But if one is only... and there is a man there... The rest of his words were lost as he passed through the gate and toward his house through the rows of slaves standing with uplifted hands. Montcalm moved a little behind him, bent over, listening and replying to what he said. And thus Joseph had seen Potiphar, as he pronounced the name to himself, that great man of Egypt to whom he had been sold.